I've known my next guest since he was born. And he's grown up into a very lovely young man, and he's very talented. He's a musician, a songwriter, a composer, and he's lovely. It's Danny Harrison. Danny, hello. How are you?
I'm good. Right. I'm really good. Yeah, I'm very good.
Are you in a cool place? Or we're talking on probably the hottest day of the summer.
So far, this is the hottest day of the year, and I'm in my studio, which is quite well insulated. But by the end of the evening, it'll probably feel like a pizza oven in here.
Yeah. It's not too bad here. I've got a window open, but it will get hotter.
It's really not as bad as they're making it out.
I know.
To be.
I heard somebody on the radio this morning say, "What's all the fuss about? We spend a fortune flying off to places that are this hot, and now we've got 2 days of it. Everyone's, God, red alert, red alert."
I used to go out to Utah and sit in the desert and like walk in the kind of in. It's like where they film that show Westworld, you know, like Pariah and Escalante and all those big Monument Valley kind of place.
Oh, I've never been there. It must be
baking hot out there.
Yeah, well, it gets to like 45 degrees, doesn't it?
The last time I was there was probably 3 years ago or 2 years ago now, but it was so hot. And that you got a poncho on, you're fine. And it's like, it's really not that bad in England today.
No, we should enjoy it, but just...
Yeah, enjoy the sun.
Enjoy the sun. So you are... You live in England, right? Because I know you lived in California for a little bit.
I lived in California probably for the last 20 years, ever since on and off, because, but mostly there, since my father passed away, it was 2001, and we were out in California when he passed away. And then I ended up staying out there to finish the record that we were working on at the time, which has its 20th anniversary next year, I think, with Jeff Lynne. And after that, I kind of just built a studio and I had a little house. Well, first I had a little apartment out there, and then I just kind of ended up moving there because there was a lot of great musicians, and, you know, I had my dad's friends, like, you know, the Wilburys and people who were very kind and lovely. And my grandmother, who passed away in 2020 in January, aged 100, who was just kind of the queen of Los Angeles, really.
Is this your mum, Olivia's mum?
My mother's
100,
mother.
Bless her.
And my grandma Lou, who was kind of a legend amongst all my friends. And so after she passed away, I didn't have as much reason to be there, but also I'm glad I kind of got out. But I was there for longer than I thought I was going to be. I was thinking I was going to move back to England after a few years. And then I had a big studio and I had lots of work and lots of friends. And that kind of community was kind of destroyed by the last few years. So I ended up shutting down my studio, and I have my studio here now. And so I'm in Friendly Henley.
And a very nice place to be too.
Back where I started.
But it's quite, I mean, I've lived in both places in various spans of time. I lived in LA in the early 70s, and then I split up from my first husband and I went to New York, and then I came back to England and kind of stayed. And then we went back to LA a second time and lived there for 4 years. So it's quite nice to, you know, through work, really.
Yeah, I had a kind of double LA experience. Like, I used to go there every couple times a year with my dad.
That's right.
You know, from when I was born, really, all the way through the 90s. And then I lived in the East Coast for a while. I did university out on the East Coast.
Yeah, you went to Brown, right?
I went to Brown.
I read in your bio. Was that amazing?
It was great. It was great fun, actually.
Great
and I was,
uni.
And I really, it's, it, I got to attend RISD, which was really nice, the Rhode Island School of Design. And I kind of crossed over with the likes of people like Shepard Fairey, and I always liked RISD because Talking Heads came from RISD, and, you know, they're like all graphic designers, and they're just cool. There's a lot of cool artists from RISD. And after that, I kind of moved back to England or in Switzerland with my dad. And then after he passed away, I kind of came back, and that was kind of like a different life in LA. But that lasted, you know, I've had like a lot of different LA lives, different parts of town where you live in. And, you know, I've been there so long that you watch kind of scenes come and go. And it changed a lot. But I think I got probably the best era of LA, because now it's in a terrible state. And I think I got the
Why is it in a terrible state? I mean, I've had friends say, you know, because of all the things going on, but
it's just a mess. And
because it was a big center for new music coming out, wasn't it? I mean, a bit like going back to the 60s when the Beach Boys and
also,
all that.
It just feels kind of like it's gone back to being, you know, how it was kind of sometime in the 80s, where it was really dodgy and there was lots of crime. And now they're not prosecuting any theft. And, you know, it's just weird. Like, there's people doing ram raids and stuff and they don't get prosecuted. It's very strange. And, and there's nothing being done about the homeless problem. It's just really sad. Like, some of the neighborhoods that were very nice neighborhoods fell into disrepair. Like, the infrastructure is kind of knackered. And yeah, it's sad what happened. I think being there in the early 2000s, all the way through to like, it got better. And then 2008 happened when the crash. I remember living in Venice Beach and it was like really up and coming. Like, it was going to be Silicon Beach and, you know, all the big tech companies were buying up land. And then it didn't quite make it. It kind of crapped out again and went back to being a bit shooty and a bit dodgy.
I'd say when I lived there in the early 70s, you couldn't go to Venice Beach. I mean, you could, but you
I know, when
you
I, back when I was a left. Kid, when I was a kid, it was a little bit like that. So I grew up skateboarding and there was, you know, great places to skateboard, but there was some places you didn't go at certain times, you know, and or certain colors that you didn't wear in certain neighborhoods, you know.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. It was pretty heavy.
Interesting.
But it was all great because my grandma was there and we used to go to the baseball. She was a huge Dodgers fan and it's just, she was like such a legend. And then after she passed away, I'm just really glad that she passed away very happily before this whole thing happened, because there would have been no way of looking after her with all of the regulations and mandates and rules.
With COVID? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have been a nightmare.
Yeah, because actually you're like my daughter Carly. You're half American, aren't you? Because your mum's American. You,
yeah.
And Carly's dad was American. So it's like.
My mother's from a Mexican family from Los Angeles. And my dad's a Scouser, which makes me a Scousican.
That's brilliant, a Scousican.
So yeah, it's quite a rare combination. I think I met another Scouskin once, but it was pretty thin on the ground.
Not many of you.
No.
So when you left Brown, I read that you went into automobile design. Is that correct?
I actually worked with I worked with McLaren cars.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Which was like my dream job. And I'd studied for years to get that job. And I got a really good job working there for Gordon Murray as the boss, who is just kind of my hero still to this day. He's a dear friend, but he was a very good friend. I actually applied to get the job without him knowing, because he was a friend of my dad's. My dad's one of his best friends. And I didn't want to get the job because I got, you know, favoritism. So when I turned up there, he was very surprised. I managed to get the job. And yeah, it was just a great time, and ended up working a little bit for McLaren International, and then went back to being a musician because I kind of moved back to LA. But it was the design element of what I was doing in school and after school for a few years was really kind of the most helpful thing, because now I have Dark Horse Records again.
Oh, do you? That's interesting. What, you've got the label?
We revived Dark Horse Records.
Oh, wow.
And it's an imprint joint venture with BMG Music International. And the lovely chaps over there at BMG and I decided to kind of try and do a project together, which is, and my creative partner who used to run my label and manage us and be kind of my creative partner, David Zonshine. So we resurrected Dark Horse and we started signing catalog as a catalog label, because originally we'd done so much work for my dad protecting his legacy and remixing, remastering his records. And the chap who I composed music with, who is a dear, dear old friend of mine from childhood, an incredible engineer, a chap called Paul Hicks, and a great composer too. He remastered all the Beatles stuff, and he was even working on the anthology when he was young. So he was very young working on the anthology. So we had this kind of great group of people. So we'd done all this great work remastering stuff for the Beatles, remastering stuff for, Paul had worked on Beatles remasters and John Lennon remasters, and we'd done George Harrison's whole catalog. And it just got to the point where people started coming to us and saying, hey, can you help us? We've got a catalog that we don't know what to do with. We've got an archive. We can see that you guys have done such great work with your archive, and you don't put out, tons of records. You don't do anything that's not like really custom and bespoke. So we started helping people, and then we're thinking, like, this is a lot of work. We should be getting paid for this. And we should also be having, building a team of people that we,
brilliant.
So the first, it started with George Harrison and Ravi Shankar. And then one of the first people, we had all the Dark Horse catalog, which was the original artists. We're bringing them back. We just relaunched, re-released all the records on digital, and then going to do a box set next year. But we were approached by, actually through, funnily enough, through Shepard Fairey, the artist, we were approached by Lucinda Garland, who is the widow of Joe Strummer and a wonderful dear friend. She became a really great friend of ours and kind of family. And she hadn't released anything with Joe since he passed away the year after my dad. So it was a very similar situation with an incredible archive and incredible music, and just so, he was so prolific, Joe, and every tape box, hand illustrated labels, just like mind-blowing amount of material. And
wow,
fortunately, the Damien Hirst had actually helped them build the archive. So it was extremely well organized, and because Damien had done lots of art with Joe and was a dear friend. And it just kind of fell to us. And, a lot of people were trying to get her to sign with them, and she ended up coming with us because it was kind of a ma and pa business, and she could see that it's family. And we became very close, and now we're doing all this great Joe Strummer stuff. We've got a Mescaleros box set coming out. We've got we just did a two limited singles and a lot of vinyl and a compilation album of stuff previously unheard.
That's so exciting. So are you bringing it out? Are you bringing it out on CDs or vinyl?
There is CD.
Isn't vinyl quite big again?
Vinyl is, yeah, we can't print enough vinyl. I mean,
it's interesting, isn't it?
We've really tried to, and I love, again, this is back to the whole design thing. It's because I was so deeply involved in all kinds of design, and it was one of those things that was a real passion of mine. I kind of became the creative director of Dark Horse, even though it's my label. Everything goes through me. So now I have an art team who build stuff for me, and they do a great job. We do, videos, animations, vinyl, CDs, all brilliant. Kinds of books. And, we do it all in-house, and there's only a few of us, but ultimately I oversee everything. And
and is that based in the UK, or is that based?
I had a chap here I work with called Darren Evans, who we just did the All Things Must Pass re-release, which didn't come out on Dark Horse, but it was the same people designing it. It came out on Universal, which was a really great release that they did for us. And we ended up winning a Grammy for that, for design, for the best box set.
Oh, congratulations.
Yeah, so that wonderful. Was a really
but
great...
But this is so exciting.
This
what
was
an amazing
last
thing.
Month or 2 months ago. So
yeah, brilliant.
It's going really well. And then the next box set that's coming out after that, which is all the same team, is the Joe Strummer Mescaleros box set. So I get really involved in the design, and I just want everything. I'm super OCD, so I really want everything to look nice on your shelf,
Quite right.
Yeah, it has to look nice. And then...
But there is something wonderful. I mean, I grew up in the era when, you got out, getting an album was so exciting because you got the artwork, you got all the notes inside. It was wonderful. You didn't only have the record to play.
Yeah.
But you had this wonderful piece of art to admire and read And you don't get that when it gets smaller.
No, it's hard. Actually, it's very hard. And there was a time with CD when it just, you really lost all artwork. But yeah, vinyl's back, and it's, I mean, it never really went away, but it's, you know, I think for the first time last year, vinyl outsold CD.
Yeah, I read that. Is it more expensive to produce vinyl than CDs?
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's also, it's just such a beautiful format.
I agree, and, 100%.
You know, I kind of push all my friends. I say, have you got a record player? Because, you know, people, sometimes they've got them and they're really into it. And sometimes they just go, no, I never really thought about getting one. It's like, well, if you get one, I'll send you lots of vinyl. And that's the
thing. We've got one.
Well, I'll send you lots of vinyl.
We've always had one.
This is the benefit of actually having your own label. You get to give people the gift of music. And especially during the lockdowns and all of that stuff, it really came in handy. You know, people thanked me so much. I just kept trying to, you know, keep making vinyl and sending it to people. And it's a real, because it's like a, it can be a talking piece too. It's like, did you hear that record I sent you? And it's funny, you know, wherever I go, it, you know, you go to restaurants, you meet the maitre d' or you meet the manager or the guy that does this or that, or you go to a hotel or something. And then there's always one person who's just a vinyl nutter, you know? And once they realize that you're the vinyl guy, then it's like, you just have these great relationships. And it's good because, you know, anyone's opinion and anyone's enjoyment of vinyl is as good as anyone else's. So
yeah,
it doesn't absolutely matter who you are. If you've got the love for the music and you like the vinyl, I love it because that just means I've got an excuse to go out and not be, you know, and have something to talk about that doesn't make me socially awkward. It makes me, it's something I know about and I can relate to people on that level.
Yeah. And I mean, Carly, her and her husband collect vinyl, and she swears that the sound is much more beautiful on vinyl.
I was having this conversation literally on Sunday. I ran into the great actor Andy Serkis, who mm-hmm. is a friend of ours through another friend, and he's also, I'm a big fan of his, you know, huge fan of his work and his family. And then I ended up sending him home with a load of vinyl. I kind of just because I've got boxes of all the different stuff here, but we were having the same thing. It was like, this is really exciting because, you know, sometimes people just think, oh, I've got a vinyl record. They never put it on. They leave it on the thing. But he was another person that was like, wow, great. You know, and his daughter was, they're very into music. And
my 7-year-old, Carly's daughter, who's seven, Joni.
Yeah. Yeah.
Named after Joni Mitchell, by the way, because both me and Carly were
great
obsessed
name.
With Joni. It's a good name, isn't it? But yeah. she even puts the, she knows how to do it. She can open the lid and put the vinyl on and put her music on. And
yeah, I mean, it's it.
And I've she got, loves it. It's lovely.
Even if you get one of those little suitcase ones that open up, I think those, you know, the ones that you can take around.
The dance set. I had one of those like when I was Crosley 15.
Or, yeah, yeah. And I even tried to start making like little toys that, they're like little toy cars that drive around the record. So you don't even have to have a record player. You just put the record on the table and you have a little toy car and you wind it up and it has like a little needle and the car drives around in circles. It goes around big circles until it going around. So it's going around little circles and then it kind of crashes into the center of the record.
So you're an inventor as well, Danny.
I like stuff. I like building treasure. You know, we did a funny thing where we brought back the gnomes from All Things Must Pass. But I had some friends who are filmmakers and they hooked me up with the guys from Pinewood Studios who do all the scanning, LiDAR scanning. So we started scanning a bunch of stuff and we ended up scanning all the gnomes off the album cover and making like little replicas. And then they went in the box set and I'm, you know, scan everything like I've scanned. Scanning the whole of the gardens here at Friar Park and the whole of the house and building digital models of everything.
Wow.
And so I like to do all this stuff because it's good, A, for archive purposes,
mm-hmm.
and B, if anything ever breaks, you've got a model of it, you can rebuild it.
That's true, actually.
Yeah. And, you know, that's when you've got a place that's like this that you have to kind of be responsible for. There's just so much maintenance.
I can't even begin to imagine the maintenance of that extraordinary. When I was talking to your mum last week, it was a guy called Crisp who bought it. Was it?
Yeah, Sir Frank Crisp. Sir Frank Crisp.
Sir Frank Crisp. And he was an eccentric multimillionaire, right?
He was a very interesting man, polymath and genius. And he built this incredible world here. But that, my dad wrote a song about him, The Ballad of Sir Frankie Crisp. And my mum, who just, the reason we ran into each other, might I say, is because my mum released a book of poetry, which I'm very proud of her for. And
well, you should be. It's so beautiful. I mean, I'm still reading it, and I go back on things, and it's so uplifting. And also, I said to your mum last week, I said, I also do it with a box of tissues because some of them are so moving.
For me, it's hard. Like, it's reliving it. Also seeing it from
She writes so eloquently. It's so beautiful.
She's really got into the flow of it. And yeah, I'm really happy for her. It was funny for me because, like, when we did the documentary my mum did with Martin Scorsese that was about my father, it was really hard watching my life through the eyes of Martin Scorsese. You know, like, there were all these big crash cuts and audio that was really loud, and then it would drop to silence, and like all very, you know, the kind of editing that you expect from a Scorsese film, you know, and it's like really crash, drops, it kind of drops you on these huge, like falling off a cliff kind of edits. And you know, after a while, I'd watched like 20 different cuts of it. And after a while, I was like, I can't watch this anymore. Yeah, it just hurts too much. And it's also like, it's through his eyes, not mine. So it's like, wow, sometimes it looked even harsher than it felt. And there was bits that I didn't necessarily want to see over and over again. Yeah,
and then
now it's like reliving it 20 years later through my mum's poetry is a totally different pain.
No, I get it, you know, completely. Like listen, I knew and absolutely adored your dad, but obviously, you know, he's your dad and he's Olivia's husband, and I can't, and it affects me so much.
Well, you guys were all great friends, and you know, and it's like when you know someone,
I know, it's
that well, it's hard enough even reading it and not knowing.
Well, I think I met your dad when I was 17, and that's how far back. We go way back.
Yeah.
And, you know, when your mum was pregnant with you, I was pregnant with Carly, because you're 3 months older than her. And then you kind of lose each other for a few years, because I went to LA and then I went to Broadway, and they were all over the place.
But that's life, though, isn't it? I mean, you kind of...
But it's lovely to, and I've seen you grow up. I've seen you running around in your shorts when you were a little boy, and you and Carly playing together. I mean,
and you kind of stayed the same age. It's pretty funny, actually.
Well, you're very kind.
I caught you up.
Hardly. Very, very kind.
But you know, that's life, isn't it? It's like we kind of logs floating down the river occasionally. You float alongside each other. And then sometimes you don't. And then you come back and then suddenly you're floating alongside again.
Yeah.
But
what's nice is when you relink, like when, you know, when we bumped into each other again, and I hadn't seen you for, I think the last time I saw you before we reconnected at Stella's 50th birthday.
Exactly. It was 50th birthday.
We had dinner with Carl. I was with Carly because I was working in LA and she came out, and we came to your house in LA with your mum for dinner.
Yeah.
That was the last time I'd seen you, which must be 10 years ago.
It's again 10 years ago. Yeah. Well, it's amazing how quickly 10 years goes by.
I know. Don't tell me.
I mean,
and I'm only 35, darling.
Exactly.
Now, the other big, big memory in my life, and you were a huge part of it, was the concert for George at the Albert Hall, which we were very lucky to be an audience member. You played, didn't you?
Which is 20 years this year.
That's right.
2002.
That was an extraordinary evening. How was that for you? Must have been such mixed emotions.
Heavy, very heavy. I mean, a lot of it was just staring at your feet, trying not to cry. Yeah. And, you know, playing Isn't It a Pity with Billy Preston and, you know, so many people, also so many people on that stage that were so close to me passed away after that. You know, Michael Kamen, the composer.
I know. Well, he was a great friend. That was a shock. Well, I know.
Michael was like my godfather, and he was like one of the closest friends of my family and just the sweetest people. And that's, I guess, why I ended up becoming a composer. Like, he was the inspiration for me. You know, I grew up watching him do.
That's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, he helped me when I was at university learn how to use music, do music on computers, you know, and like learn how to compose. And
yeah, because you do, I'm sure people know this, but you, as well as doing your personal music, you compose for film and TV series.
And television.
And television. Is it a huge difference kind of in a mindset of when you're composed? Do they send you the film and you have to watch it and put music to it? How does that work? I'm not 100% sure how it works.
When you score stuff to picture, it's you know, that you're getting revised cuts all the time. People are sending you, you know, cut, and then maybe they make an edit and you have to change the score to fit the edit. And then sometimes you get like a kind of vibe of what's going on, and then you'll send a piece of music, and then sometimes they will cut to the piece of music that you wrote. So like, if you're Hans Zimmer and Christopher Nolan, that's like, they'll work these big pieces that they do. They'll tend to cut these big sequences to the score. And, you know, it works both ways round, which is, it's just however you can get it in there. But a lot of the time, you know, whatever goes in there first, people get kind of married to that. So it's like, you've got to try and keep it fresh, I guess. I did a film just recently, which is, if anyone sees it being shopped around, I hope they get to see it, because it's going around festivals and stuff now. And it's called Futra Days, F-U-T-R-A. And it's a director called Brian David Schindler. And we did his first film, Seattle Road, which was a really great kind of trippy sort of dramatic art piece. And I really had fun doing that. And it was funny because I did that film score, and then the kind of palette of things that I'd built, sounds and things that I was working with, had infiltrated my brain so much that I then ended up, the record that I brought out, which was my solo record a couple of years back called In Parallel, was kind of like a companion.
Oh, that's
like
interesting.
The score. And if you listen, like if you got the score and then you listen to In Parallel, you would hear that they were like related. And funnily enough, Ryan's second film, Future Days, is kind of the same for my new album. And so I've just finished that score, and I finished that score about 6 months ago, and then I just finished my new record, which I don't
have. When does that come out?
We're probably beginning of next year, because, you know, anything now, it's like, it takes 9 months to make vinyl. This is because of just the world at the moment. Yeah. Everything takes a long time. So,
But that's exciting. So it'll be out early 23.
I think so. Yeah. Beginning of next year, you know, provided there is still a world to release it into.
Oh, please. There will be. No, there will be. It's a very different world that I grew up in.
Oh, totally.
But you know, if you look back through history, the world changes and, you know. Civilizations. We were watching a thing last night, which was really interesting, on one of the streaming channels, about Caesar and that world, and they were the powerhouse of the world, you know.
Well, it's definitely changing, and this, the world, what I kind of meant was like the world that we knew was going away, and this new wonderful earth is happening, and you know, it's
but I'm sure you'll agree with me, the most important real thing really without, you know, not politics and all that, is, you know, making sure the planet's all right.
Yeah.
I mean, and what's amazing, my 7-year-old granddaughter, God bless her, all of the kids, they're very aware of it. Because when I was little, we didn't even talk about things like that at school, but the schools are informing the children. They feel, I mean, she tells me off if I put the wrong piece of rubbish in the wrong bin. And she's seven.
There's definitely a move towards consciousness. And I, you know, how much that's being hijacked for a greenwash agenda, you know, some things are good, some things are bad. And also, like, you know, the real polluters out there, it's like, that's the thing that we have to really look at, I think, the pollution and who are the real polluters, you know?
And they're the hardest ones to change.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, it's everyone has to do their bit, obviously, but we've got to look at the real polluters.
The bigger picture.
Yeah.
No, I totally,
yeah, because
I totally
otherwise it's just a paltry offering, you know? We have to do it properly. Which is part of the way that the world is changing, you know, and it's like that, things like that no one knew before. And now people know that stuff. And even in the last 3 years, there's so much information about the world and the way it actually works.
Yeah.
That people know now, and names of people who are, you know, infamous or you know, who were just all hiding before. And now they're all, you can see what's happening. And it's kind of a very much like a veil being lifted from how society is really functioning. And I think that the people really have to go back to being community-based. And
yeah, I agree.
It's that choice point, you know? I keep seeing the diagram everywhere where it's like, if you choose the point that's now, and if we move forward with love and with community and collaboration and, you know, acceptance and genuinely collaboration, you know, like.
But your dad was a front runner of these feelings and the spirituality. I was talking to your mum about it, actually, because that was quite new and forward thinking then.
Totally. And
you know, because it was the 60s, it was all free love and you can do anything. And he had a different mindset, and there was a wonderful inbuilt sense of what is right and what's wrong and the beauty of the world. And how, I mean, it's interesting. He was, you know, really ahead of his time in that thinking and trying to get it over in his music, which he did, in his songs.
I also feel like, you know, it's that whole thing as well, which is, you know, opening people's eyes to things being legal or things being moral, you know, because there's so many things that are legal but are just morally bankrupt and terrible.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, and it doesn't mean that just because something's illegal or it's legal for
listen,
them
it's
to do that.
Legal to have a machine gun in America.
Well, it's just, you know, it's legal to do, you know, terrible things, and that doesn't mean that you can just say, oh well, that's illegal, so we can get away with it.
I totally agree.
I think the whole thing is coming from a moral perspective now, and like what's actually right, natural law, you know, and breaking natural law is not good. And when you have, like, the choice point we were saying, it's if you're living in fear, and it's that spiral of awareness, if it's loving awareness, it's going outwards and it's helping people collaborate and unify. And if it's defensive awareness, it's going inwards. It's going inwards and it's selfish and it's fear and it's choosing to give over your autonomy to whoever will take it, whether it's a corporation or a government or, you know, some people will manipulate you if you give up your autonomy. So it's very much choosing to be ruled or choosing to be free, you know? And I think that this is, when I say the world left, I mean, like, my record is very much, I guess, talking about this. And
oh, good.
But from my perspective, in just as a person on the ground, just as a, from what I've experienced, you know, it's funny because I see it changing so much that by the time my record comes out, it might not be relevant anymore. We may have solved the problem.
Oh, I'm sure it will. Anyway, I'm sure it'll be a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of music anyway. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know we've got to wind up pretty soon because I know you're busy. You played with amazing people when they inducted your dad into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Tell me about that, because it sounds amazing.
It was an interesting night.
Tell us who you played with.
I got to see one of my favorite bands, Traffic, were inducted the same day.
Yeah, Stevie Winwood.
Yeah, Stevie Winwood and Jim Capaldi, who was, again, back to what we were saying when we got distracted on the stage for Concert for George. Jim Capaldi was another one that isn't around anymore. And Billy Preston, another one that passed away. You know, all of those people on that stage there's a lot of people there who aren't around anymore. Yeah. And, you know, Ravi, you know, who'd written the piece, Ravi Shankar, you know. So, you know, what we're doing with our label, trying to protect all of that great music and get it back out to everyone. But that night in New York was...
Was it Tom Petty?
Tom Petty, Jeff Lynne, and we Stephen Winwood and Capaldi. And then we had Eric's band. Oh, no, we had the Heartbreakers. It was the Heartbreakers.
Oh, okay.
And...
I read somewhere Prince was in the lineup. No,
Prince,
was that not...
Prince had been inducted earlier in the day.
Oh, okay.
And actually, they had this thing where all of the promoters, all the managers, not in the organizers of the event, were desperately trying to put him into our mix. And we were trying to honor my dad, which was being playing things the way that we'd done it. And, you know, we'd rehearsed very specifically. I had Mark Mann on guitar doing all the solos perfectly, like we did at Concert for George. And they ended up throwing a cat amongst the pigeons and putting Prince on with us. And it was funny because Jeff Lynne and Tom, you know, it was hard for them to just throw Prince into the mix. And they,
of course, you know,
there's the kind of grumpy dad vibe where it's like, who's this guy, you know? And but they were also very, you know, like everyone knows how amazing Prince was, right? Yeah. But his attitude was a little bit too much. You know, he was like, okay, we weren't necessarily seeing eye to eye.
Okay.
So they kind of stuffed me in between Prince and the Heartbreakers and Jeff because I was the youngest. And it was like, okay, you like Prince, you know, put Danny in the middle. So that's why I just couldn't, like, I was just nervous laughing all the way through because I knew that's what was going to happen. And I knew that he was going to do like this insane guitar solo because he'd done it a little one in soundcheck, and he was kind of, he did that whole bait and switch thing where he was like, oh, I'm just going to play this. It's like, no, I could see that he was about to just try and blow everyone away because he'd been inducted earlier in the day. And I think, I think he was a bit miffed that he didn't get the finale, right? So he wanted
And
George we were the finale, the Guitar Gently Weeps. So it kind of made for a perfect storm.
I have to say that's one of my favorite songs ever. Have you got a favorite dad song of your dad?
I think my favorite dad song is like Run of the Mill.
Oh, really? That's
and
interesting.
And I think it's a lot to do with the lyrics, you know, everyone.
I mean, there's so many gorgeous songs, but I think My Guitar Gently, well, it's always just been one of my favorite songs anyway, across the board. It's so beautiful.
It's one of those ones that after Prince and after, you know, Clapton at Concert for George and Billy and stuff, like, we've kind of retired that song for guitar players now. It's like, you know what I mean? It's like, no one's going to do that any more than they did. So, like, people are always like, will you play Guitar Gently Weeps at this concert? No. We're done. When, not after the, you know, Prince kind of jumped backwards into the crowd and threw his guitar and I'm just standing there laughing and laughing. And everyone's like, why are you laughing so much? I'm like, I'm laughing at how bombastic and ridiculous it was. But at the same time, it great showmanship. You know, Prince is such a great performer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. Bless him.
But I was laughing at just like, I could just hear the thoughts in everyone's heads, you know, and it was just like, I was right in the middle, just listening to this all That's of the thoughts so of everyone. Funny. And I just couldn't stop laughing. And I think the funny thing was, because I'm standing right behind Prince and he disappears off the stage because he's like a backbend. So that most of the footage is just of me laughing.
The other thing I read that really made me laugh, when you were little, I think you got when you were six, you had a drumming lesson from a quite unknown drummer called Ringo Starr.
Yeah,
and then he played the drum so loud it frightened you. Is that true, or is that just one of those stories?
I lived in a very quiet house with, like, you know, I was like a meditating child in the middle of a forest, and Ringo comes and bashes this big kid. And I was like, couldn't die. I ran out of the room crying, I think.
That is so sweet.
But I do play the drums now, and I play the drums. Yeah, I play the drums on my new record, actually. I love playing the drums. And yeah, I've been trying to convince people to let me be the drummer in their band, and no one's taking it. I've got no takers. If anyone needs a drummer out there.
Okay. Got a drummer for hire.
Yeah, drummer for hire.
Listen, it's been so lovely talking to you. I finally got to talk to you, and although I've known you all your life, it's lovely to kind of
Yeah, it's nice to sit down and have a chat.
A chat.
Bit hot for tea today, so I got myself
I was going to ask you. Well, do you drink tea? Are you a tea drinker?
I'm an Earl Grey in the morning kind of guy, and I try not to drink too much of it because it makes me shake after 3 o'clock. But yeah.
Yeah, see, tea doesn't, I don't drink coffee because
I don't drink coffee.
It makes my heart palpitate. Yeah, I've got a lemon and ginger tea, lukewarm, and that's quite nice. I've got a
celery and ginger green juice right now, ooh, which is setting me up for the day.
That's very nice. Well, I hope your building goes well.
Oh, my build is
can we come and see it when it's all done?
When it's done, you have to come for tea.
Well, we're going to come out and see your mum in the autumn. So
come and visit us in the garden. And
I'll bring Carly because she'd love to see you.
Yes, it will be a good catch up. And all of you guys.
We'll have tea in the garden.
Tea in the garden, yeah.
Lovely.
Well, I wish you the nicest of hot days and today. And I hope you keep cool. And everyone out there who's listening on this day, if it's probably raining when you're listening to this, but today was really hot. So we hope everyone had a
very
nice
hot
time.
But enjoy it.
Enjoy
and be
it.
Careful.
Go and put your feet in the pond or something, in the river.
Just don't jump in.
Yeah. Well, lots of love and thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
On this lovely show that you have.
I'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Bye. Oh, that was fabulous catching up with Danny, although it is the hottest day of the year. Probably go and jump in a cold bath now, I think. But I really look forward to his album coming out, which we'll have to look out for next year, early next year, and all the exciting things he's doing. It's lovely. Anyway, keep cool. When this goes out, it'll probably be cold. And we'll be moaning again, as usual. We always moan about the weather in this country. Anyway, keep well, stay safe. See you soon. Bye. If this is your first time listening to Tea with Twiggy, please do remember to tell your friends. You can also subscribe for free on your podcast app and listen to all my previous guests. If you want to connect with me, I'd love to hear from you. You can find me on Twitter at Twiggy, or you can find me on Instagram at Twiggy Lawson. My thanks go to all the people that have helped this podcast happen. Many thanks to James Carroll and all the team at North Bank Talent Management. Thanks to all the team at Stripped Media, including Ben Williams, who edits the show, my producer Kobe Omanaka, and executive producers Tom Wally and Dave Corkery. The music you can hear now is my version of Waterloo Sunset by The Kinks. If you'd like to hear the whole song, you can find it and all the other songs I've recorded on iTunes and Spotify. So check it out. I look forward to you joining me for my next episode. So see you then. Bye.
Just heard a Stripped Media production.